Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Best Ever You Show with your host, Elizabeth Hamilton Garino, CEO and founder of the Best Ever You Network. The Best Ever You Show is here to help you live your life to the fullest. How? Real people, including celebrities, real advice, real places, products and businesses, real life stories. With this radio show, printed magazine, websites, community, and more. And now, here is your host, Elizabeth.
Well, good evening, everyone. We don't usually do our shows at night. It's 8 p.m. here on Tuesday, February 12th here in the United States. But we have a wonderful guest with us tonight, Camilla Chance, author Camilla Chance from Australia. And so welcome, Camilla. And what time is it in Australia and what day is it?
It is 12 noon and it is February the 13th. So it's the anniversary of something very important I'll refer to later on February the 13th, very important here. And thank you so much, Elizabeth. It's a great honor to be with you. Thank you all, your listeners as well, for your hospitality. I believe you, Elizabeth, and your listeners are in the forefront of making it so fashionable to try to be your very best, that the people who believe in it will entirely overcome the violence in the world. Making this happen is the most important work a person can do today, I believe, and I'm sure you're in the forefront. And you know, you kept putting off our interview because you were racing to finish a book that you and Dr. Katie Eastman have coming out. Percolate. Let your best self filter through. So I thought I'd put a plug in.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's so exciting, and I think, you know, it's such an honor to have you with us, and I'm just so incredibly, incredibly proud, and I feel blessed, and I want to, before we begin, I'm going to tell people about you in a minute here, but I do want to just give a shout-out to our dear friend in New York, Sherry Rosen. She's just becoming a dear friend of mine. I just I can't thank her enough for all the wonderful blessings that she just continues to shine in my life, and I just get to meet people like you because of her. It's just, she's just neat and wonderful, and thank you, Sherry Rosen, for all that you do. And thank you, Camilla, for being with us, and to everybody in Australia and the United States and around the world. Get set for the next hour. We'll try and keep it to an hour, and we're going to learn all about this wonderful book called, in short, it's called Wisdom Man, but the long title is Wisdom Man by Banjo Clark, as told to Camilla Chance, the compassionate life and beliefs of a remarkable Aboriginal elder, an Australian Aboriginal elder. And before we get all into that, I just want to talk a little bit about you, if we could, Camilla. You were born of Russian, Irish, and English parentage. And how did you come to Australia in 1946?
Oh, wow. Because I was six and I couldn't help it. England was not big enough to contain my grandfather and my father. My father was fighting during the war, and after the war, he went into his father's business, and the people on the board got sick of him and my grandfather fighting all the time, and they said, you've got to do something about this. So my grandfather sent him to Australia in a very traditional manner. So that's what happened.
And you, and you worked as an editor. Tell us a little bit about all the neat jobs that you've had, because English teacher and lyric writer and book reviewer and all these things. It's what a wonderful life.
Well, I didn't expect to talk about me, but yes, I was an editor for Faber and Faber, the publishers in England, in London, and I've written lyrics for the Kabaon Cossacks, who were a wonderful group from the Ukraine who sang and danced all over the world, and they danced and sang three times a night, every night, including Christmas Day in Las Vegas. So people were not bored with them. And they had this most beautiful, soulful Ukrainian music. They said when a people is oppressed, they put all their emotions into their music because that's safe. They don't have to speak out. They put it there. And they wanted English lyrics to this beautiful, soulful music, which was on their popular song. They were the latest popular songs. And so that's what they did, and they danced on their elbows, which is even more extreme than traditional Russian dancing, where they kick out their legs. But these ones did both at the same time.
Oh, wow.
And what else have I done? I don't know. I wrote a lot of articles and book reviews for two top Australian newspapers, trying to make a bridge between the cultures of Aboriginal people and white Australians of European stock. And so I wrote a huge number of articles for them for 2 years, and things started happening then. A lot happened after that.
And in 1975, you became an incredibly close friend with Banjo Clark. And at his request, you continued interviewing him until he passed away 25 years later. And that's really kind of really what we're here to talk about is your book. It's people listening along can go to wisdommanbook.com. And again, the book is Wisdom Man by Banjo Clark, as told to Camilla Chance. And I just would just love to hear how you met Banjo Clark.
Well, what happened was that a whole lot of Baha'is of different nationalities came to stay with me in 1975. And just quickly, the Baha'i faith is a religion that started in 1844 that says humankind is basically one family. And one of my visitors was a 16-year-old tribal Australian Aboriginal from the north. And he expressed the desire to meet local Aboriginals. So we all went and sat in the grass outside the Aboriginal settlement, 10 miles away, and this young man played the guitar and sang. A carload of Aboriginal men drove past and had a good look at us, and eventually the people sent a woman out to invite us in. They'd obviously consulted all of them together first. She took us to 5 houses and introduced us to everyone. Banjo was in the last house. My 4-year-old daughter ran to him, and he gave her a big hug. Mm-hmm. And that's how everything started.
Isn't that cute? Aww. That's about, you know, that's funny. That's about how old I would have been, too. I would have been 6. Right then. In 1975, I would have been 6. That's so cute.
Oh, lovely.
Isn't that the most precious?
I can feel for you at 6.
Oh, that's just precious. And what did, and were they just buddies ever since? I mean, forever and ever? I mean, that just had to be such a moment.
Oh, yes. He asked for work. And he came and built a fence along our river so that our children would not fall into the river because there was a great big cliff. And he became like a grandfather to my children. Yes, we became very close.
Beautiful. Yes. Oh, that just warms your heart, doesn't it? Just thinking about that. Oh, incredible.
A foundation of love.
Oh, yes. You know, absolutely. And so many things just come from that. It's just amazing. Just when it comes from your heart, the world's right, isn't it? It's just amazing.
Yes. Whatever you do from your heart, it will dovetail with what is right for everybody else. Yes, I believe that.
Yeah, I hear it in your voice. Wise. So you go from that moment of your daughter hugging him and him hugging her. Now, fast forward all the way to right now, and there's a movie coming out. There's an Australian Aboriginal film coming to the United States early this year, if it's not here already, called The Sapphires. And it received a 10-minute standing ovation at the prestigious Cannes Film Festival. I'm curious how your book ties in with that. how Wisdom Man ties in.
Well, yes, Elizabeth, it's true. The Australian Aboriginal film The Sapphires is about to have its premiere in the United States on March the 22nd. The film is a crowd pleaser set in the 1960s, and it was inspired by a real event when two sisters and two cousins from Kamaragunja Aboriginal Mission regularly sang together, and the two sisters eventually toured Vietnam singing to the American troops. Now, Wisdom Man by Banjo Clark, as told to Camilla Chance, or Chance, is the autobiography and philosophy of an Aboriginal elder written down by me at his request and now on Kindle. Banjo Clark is the hero of my book, and his mother came from Kamaragunja Mission, where the girls in the film The Sapphires came from. The film reminded me greatly of Banjo's mother, whom I knew well, and I found it deeply moving. I loved and respected all Banjo's old people and feel about them as my family, and I took two members of Banjo's family to see the film The Sapphires, and they were deeply moved because much in the film is stated publicly for the first time.
I can hear everything in your voice. I think you're just so excited to see all of this is years and years and years of work. I know I'm
coming together.
Yeah. It really is. What's that like to hear for you? Just what's that like to hear of a movie getting a 10-minute standing ovation? What does that mean to you?
I'm so glad I've lived to see the day. I think the world is turning into paradise at an accelerated rate, and then you're helping.
Yeah. Well, that's a huge deal to have a movie like that come out. So March 22nd is the big day there. And again, the movie is called The Sapphires, and that's pretty easily Googleable. I call it Googleable. If you just Google The Sapphires, boy, pages of information come up on that movie. So that's just really, you know, really exciting to see. And I'm curious with all of this, why is it that you feel such a deep connection to the Aboriginal people? Why is that? What is that for you?
Well, Elizabeth, Banjo and many other Aboriginal people said they found me very easy to understand, and white people have always found me difficult to understand. When I came to Australia at the age of 6, very unwillingly, because actually we were about to go to a, you know, we'd lived in London throughout the war because the army took over our house and General Eisenhower made his headquarters there in the country. And so we were about to leave London after the war and go to this house with a forest full of squirrels. And instead we ended up in Australia. But anyway, Australia, when I came at the age of 6, felt alien to me. And it was fashionable then among white Australians to say that they had a love-hate relationship with the land, that white farmers could pour years of work into their farms only to have it destroyed in an instant by fire, flood, and drought, as if the land were taking revenge. And I guess I'm super sensitive, but I couldn't bear to be surrounded by that kind of feeling. To me, trust had to be a huge component of love. And when I met my husband, I even felt I couldn't marry him because I couldn't bear to live in Australia. But when I first met Aboriginal people in 1962, I found that they loved and trusted the land with their whole being. They knew, if they had done nothing wrong, that their land would protect them and show them where water was when they were thirsty and provide for every need when it arose. They trusted the land as they trusted the spiritual realm to look after them. And so by teaching me, Aboriginal people were hugely responsible for my marriage.
Hmm. Yeah, that's something to think about, right? That's deep, right? That's definitely that's an interesting answer because I wasn't expecting that from you at all. And I'm thinking about what comes to mind as you were talking was sort of like a trust the universe kind of thing. And there's definitely two ways of thinking right there where people are mad, angry, upset, feeling, you know, not happy or grateful. And then there's a complete flip side of gratefulness, gratitude, love, trust. And that's where you gravitated.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
yes. Yes.
I'm curious. Can I back up just a little bit and just ask you? A lot of people. This is totally off, but a lot of people love Australia, you know. And I suppose when you're six, you know, it's like telling my four boys, "Okay, guys, we got to move" or something. I can only imagine the response I would get. But have you come to just absolutely cherish living in Australia? Do you love it?
Well, where I'm living now, it's in paradise, yes. And people don't have that attitude anymore, as a matter of fact, the attitude that they had so long, very proudly saying, we have a love-hate relationship with the land, mm-hmm. which was what white people were saying all the time, very cynically. But I honestly think that it was guilt over what had been done to Aboriginal people that was making them feel the land was hostile, the land was going to take revenge on them, and now it is completely different. And that feeling is not there anymore. My children have never encountered it.
Nice.
So there
yeah.
we are. It's completely different.
Good.
Yeah,
yeah. You know, I dream one day of being able to go to Australia. I mean, that is just...
Well, you come and visit me.
Oh, I would love
to. I live
to.
In paradise. You come and visit me.
Oh.
I live in the rainforest.
Do you? I bet that
it's
is.
Rainforest.
Oh, I just can't wait. You and I will email pictures back and forth or something. I'll show you all the snow in Maine.
I know you've had a huge storm in Maine.
Three feet of snow. It's like, you got to be kidding me. And then you know what it did
and
the next day? It decided to snow some more, another 5 inches. So we didn't just get, you know, 3 feet of snow. It decided to play a joke on us and snow the next day. So, but, you know, it's interesting.
And you laughed.
Well, yeah, I absolutely laughed. And then I went out with the dog and my kids and jumped in it just for fun, you know. But, you know, the interesting thing about being an adult right now and interviewing you and you're from Australia and all these things is that when I was in fifth grade, this is back to, you know, many moons ago when I was in fifth grade. My teacher loved Australia. And I think she abandoned curriculum to teach us about Australia. I really do. Because she loved it. And I think any chance she got, she threw in Australia stuff and food from Australia. And I remember doing an entire report on the animals of Australia. And so,
yes, they're unique. Yes.
Oh, so you know, it's just really interesting how you just as a youth you come across things and then they materialize in your adulthood and you just sort of always love them and you kind of figure out why all of a sudden. It's like, you know, I just
well, come and stay with me.
Yeah.
Every morning and every evening, kangaroos come and feed close to my house.
Yeah.
Every morning and every evening I feed kookaburras, which are lovely birds, and they have a call like a laugh, like a person laughing.
Mm-hmm.
And they even teach their young to call like that, to have that laugh. And you hear them teaching them. And I feed them every morning, and today there were 7 kookaburras just a few minutes ago, eating up beef, actually.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
It's just fascinating. Yeah, my dad's best friend loves Australia too, so I've got it on my list of wonderful places to visit, and I definitely I'm going to take you up on that because I just want to be there. And okay, so let's go back to that was my Australian sidetracking us a little bit, but let's go back and just talk again about the Sapphires for a moment and the film. In the Sapphires film, one of the young women was abducted from her family as a child. Ugh. Does that happen with all Aboriginal children, and why, or did just, I can't imagine that. Explain that a little bit, because that was a little disturbing, a lot disturbing.
It's absolutely terrible, yeah. Aboriginal children were stolen from their parents on an immense scale, not because they were black, but because they were not black. Many had white fathers, and in general, only those whose descendants could pass as white in a generation or two were taken. The policy was assimilation as much as possible, so there would be less of a so-called Aboriginal problem. As you can imagine, Elizabeth, the policy caused terrible heartbreak and fear among Aboriginal people. But thank God, on the 13th of February, 2008, our Prime Minister issued a sincere and deeply emotional apology to the Aboriginal people on behalf of past governments. Today, for me, the 13th of February, is the anniversary of that apology. Yeah.
That's I don't even know the word for that. that's a huge, that's what I'm going to go with. That's just a huge thing to do. How did an apology like that come about? Was it just something he decided to do, or was it called for, or you know, how did that work? Say that again.
Through many successive governments, Aboriginal people had been begging for an apology.
Right.
They said, "You don't have to do anything. You don't have to give us money. We're not interested in that. But if the world does not acknowledge that it happened, how can we begin to heal?" And so that was the point of the apology, that they would begin to heal once people admitted it had happened, because it was the best kept secret. It's referred to now by Aboriginal people as the best kept secret. It really, white people didn't know that it was on this massive scale. Two generations were taken away on a massive scale. And, of course, this broke up families. And anybody who had a lightly skinned child, and that doesn't have to be very lightly skinned, kept on the move. Because if they were in a school too long, people would get to know and know when the parents would be away or when the child was going to be vulnerable. And anyhow, the children usually got taken away in class. Police and welfare workers would descend on the classroom and pick out children, point to the various children and take them from there. And they'd be taken kicking and screaming from the car into the police cars, and the windows would be wound up and they'd go off. And mothers would be running out after the cars until they collapsed. And the children were given new names, new birth certificates, doctors, everybody was secretly involved. And the children were told their parents were dead. And any letters from parents, those who could write, were just put in the incinerator. And that's how it was. It was the best kept secret. You know, white people were just told that families that weren't caring properly for their children were having their children removed by welfare workers. But in fact, it was a policy, and it was the slightest excuse these children were taken. It was massive. And the thing is that until 1967, in most states, Aboriginal people were under the Flora and Fauna Act, not under anything as people, as citizens. And so you could do anything you liked to Aboriginal people. If you liked a little child, you could take it away for a pet, you know.
Yeah,
and in 1967, we had all the people voting on whether Aboriginal people should be counted as citizens. And, you know, there was a massive yes from all the white people, yeah. So that's what happened. Yes, it was huge, and
you know,
it was best kept secret.
Yeah, and I guess I have so many questions right there, and just one of them is, I've got a giant why, you know, still. I just can't even imagine people behaving that way. It's heart-wrenching and heartbreaking and everything, but did they hurt these children? I mean, did the children wind up dead, abused? How are they today? Pardon my lack of knowledge, but I mean, what happened? If you were abducted and taken, did you end up okay, or what else happened to you, for example?
Well, I have met a massive number who have come back and found their Aboriginal roots, even though they were not told they were Aboriginal. And those, 100%, those whom I have met, and I have met a lot, have said, I had an older brother or sister who looked after me. He or she is dead now. Mm. So those who were looked after, and they were usually not actually a brother or sister, they were usually somebody, an older child who looked after them, because families were split up as a policy. The children went to different orphanages. But anyway, those who survived had an older sibling or friend who took the brunt of maltreatment, what was done to them.
It's awful. What's the tie-in or the thread between the same situation in America and Aboriginals? You know, there's a lot of racism and just non-loving behavior that goes on.
Yes, well, of course, there are two races. There are Native American people and there are African American people who have both suffered horrendously.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no right to speak for African Americans or Native American people. And as far as Aboriginals go, I will only state what Banjo entrusted me to say. However, I do know that Aboriginals have always felt kinship with African American struggles and Native American struggles. And when Dr. Martin Luther King died, for example, it hurt Aboriginal people deeply. Mm-hmm. I do know that the Dred Scott case in the United States in 1857 upheld that slaves were not citizens. And before 1967, I told you about what happened to Aboriginal people. Yeah. And I do know also, as a matter of fact, that a few centuries ago, there was terrible fear among Native American people of the blue-eyed people on horseback who used to come and take the children away to residential schools. Mm. And that was very hard on them, and most of them didn't survive. And it seems that those who did survive got together and had little secret, the children at night had little secret Native American ceremonies and kept their culture going. But most, I believe, did not survive. That happened a long time ago, but that did happen.
Yeah. Let's go back to that.
But I have no right to speak about that.
No, yeah, but, I mean, you can see the similarities. I mean, it's certainly, there's just, I agree with you. I don't know that I have any right to speak on it either, other than, you know, you just do your best in the world to treat people with, you know, kindness and love. And respect and all those words that are meaningful and not just words but practice, and it doesn't matter what color you are, what race you are, how old you are, how young you are, where you're from, it's human dignity and kindness that make us all our best, and so it's, you know, that's what I believe anyway. I don't know. People believe whatever they believe, but that's how I try to treat people.
Yes,
I would like, yeah.
It's becoming more so.
Yeah, I hope so.
I feel it's becoming more so. And, of course, this is a Baha'i principle. You know, we are all one. Yes.
Yeah.
Unity in diversity. From 1844, it has been stated very firmly in the Baha'i faith. Yeah.
Well, to go back to that apology, you know, that is so important today, February 13th, 2008, where an apology has been issued to the Aboriginal people. I think about something like that, and I think, okay, it's great that there's an apology and everything, but there's another step there of forgiveness. Is that happening? Is there deep forgiveness in their hearts?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yeah.
All over Australia, they said an apology needs a response. You either accept it or you do not accept it. And they held these dinners with white guests of honor, and our present Governor General was the guest of honor to the dinner I was invited to. And they were, you had to wear mauve, which was supposed to be the color of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And all these dinners were held to say, we forgive, you know, we accept the apology. And actually, the Australian Governor-General was supposed to be sitting at a different table, but she chose to sit at the table where I was sitting with my Aboriginal friends who invited me.
Mm-hmm.
So she sat next to me. So I didn't know why I had to do this, but I had put a copy of the book Wisdom Man in my purse. So I gave it to her. Yeah, so she knows all about Banjo Clark, and she wrote me a beautiful thank you letter.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, good. Yeah, I was hoping that, you know, because, you know, apologies are wonderful, but there's a whole component of the art of forgiveness that goes with them, so that people can grow and move on and love again, and, you know,
yes,
just all the things that go with that. And it's hard when you're mad or upset or hurt or wronged or whatever to forgive sometimes. So that
something strange is happening in this telephone. Can you hear it?
No, I can't. Is it okay?
Oh
yeah,
no,
I can a little
stopped.
Bit. It's lagging a little bit, but yeah, I think it's okay. Chat room.
Sorry,
we have a chat room
that.
Open. No, it's okay. We have a chat room open on the call. I'm hoping you guys can hear us okay. If you can't, just type in. And if anybody has any questions for Camilla, just ask. Type them in, and we can ask her some questions. It's a beautiful book, and Camilla, you're just a beautiful soul. It's wonderful to be able to speak with you, you know, especially for a full hour. How cool is that? So let's keep
Thank
going.
You.
I have so many questions for you, and we'll get through them here. I'm really curious. Why? Well, I think we've kind of covered this a little bit, but why do the Aboriginal people have trust for you, you know, as a white woman? You know, it's, you know, there's a lot of people, that's got to be hard in a way.
Yes, in some ways it was very hard, but Aboriginal people can see into people's hearts.
Mm.
And also I believed their stories of cruelty, Elizabeth, where most white people didn't, as you know.
Yeah.
Because I, too, had been told as a child that I had no right to exist. And it was a wonderful relief for me to meet people who could see into my heart. So, yes, two ways.
Mm,
it
yeah,
went, was two-way.
That's wonderful. And they, I hear you, too, with your... You love nature with your rainforest and your kookaburras,
yes,
and your kangaroos and everything.
Yes.
They're also very close to nature, and they see the spiritual world as part of their community. I'm wondering if you have any stories that can maybe better bring this point out and maybe illustrate it for us, so we can hear what it is. That seems to be a really important part of them.
Yes, I have close to a million stories, Elizabeth. But I'll tell you about when Banjo's first born, little Vernon, was 16 months old. He had been sick in the past, but he'd been better for a long while. But on June the 7th, 1947, this little boy spent the whole day standing by the window. Whenever anybody passed on the road, he'd run the 60 yards to it and shake the person's hand. people driving a horse and cart, all the children coming home from school. It was as if he were saying goodbye. Of course, his parents became very uneasy. And sure enough, late in the evening, little Vernon suddenly found it hard to breathe. The family was driven to the hospital, and Vernon was kept overnight. Then at 3 o'clock in the morning, the school teacher arrived at Banjo and his wife's house and said the hospital had telephoned and he would drive them in. They didn't know what they'd find, but a nurse told them on arrival that the little boy had passed away peacefully. She took them to Vernon's room in the hospital. He was lying in his cot with a beautiful flower in his hands. Banjo told me it was a camellia, but his wife insisted it was a rose. Banjo wanted to find out how the nurse understood that Vernon always had wild flowers in his hands at home, because he loved flowers. And the nurse confessed that somehow he looked so beautiful that she felt he needed a flower to be complete. Banjo said to me, his spirit must have told her, I want a flower now, so that when my people come, they'll see me in the way they've always seen me. But there's more. That evening, Banjo and his wife saw little Vernon's special mate, known as Uncle Terrick, come across the paddock and take his hat off. For the first time, he was not holding the bunch of wild flowers he always brought for Vernon. He must know the bad news already, they thought, and yet there was no way he could have. He'd been away in town, then stayed at a halfway house where he would not have seen anyone from the mission. Banjo went out to him. And now, if I may, Elizabeth, I'll read from the book, Wisdom Man.
I would be honored.
I said, I've got bad news for you, Uncle. Yeah, he said. I know. Did somebody tell you? I asked. It's the little boy, eh? Yes, I said. Our little boy passed away at 3 o'clock this morning. I know. I asked him again if he'd run into someone who told him. No, I went straight home. I didn't see anybody. And I never asked any more questions. Then 3 months after we buried the little fella, old Uncle Terrick said, now I'll tell you about your little boy and how I knew he passed away that night. I was very curious to hear the explanation. As usual, my friends put me up overnight when I was halfway home. But at about 3 o'clock in the morning, I was awakened by something pressing at my feet. I thought a dog had come into the old bungalow and jumped on the foot of my bed. I wanted to hunt him off. I yelled at him, but the weight stayed just the same. So I reached across and found the matches, he continued, so I could sit up in bed to look at the weight on my feet. I struck a match, and I saw that on the foot of my bed lay a little white coffin. Straight away, I thought about my little mate Vernon, as if he had put the idea into my head, like he was telling me something. So I wasted no time at all hanging around in the morning. I had to come over to you as soon as possible.
You know, how did Banjo, you know, just, thank you for reading that, first of all, and thank you for sharing the stories. But how did Banjo himself survive his son passing away? How did he do that and go through that? That's they say that's just the worst thing a parent can go through, is burying their own child or children. What happened to him? I'm curious.
I'm afraid it's a way of life for Aboriginal people. child death has been very, very common. Very few Aboriginal children have lived to adulthood, really. I've met a lot of Aboriginal people who've buried their children.
Mm.
Grief is a way of life, but at the same time, they allow their grief totally. And as a result, of course, they allow joy totally. I've been to a lot of Aboriginal balls which were held to raise money for their funeral fund. So people were happy, having an exciting time with a floor show of Aboriginal people imitating kangaroos and all sorts of things, very, very sensitive. And it's all been to raise money for their funeral fund. So there's all the great happiness and the great sorrow, and people are not ashamed of it. You know, when there were the terrible massacres in the early days, Aboriginal people just looked on those who massacred them as children who hadn't been taught properly, because certainly the way I was brought up still, you became an adult when you learnt to squash your feelings. And to Aboriginal people, it's exactly the opposite. You become an adult when you have channeled your emotions so that you are very emotional, but it's the right feelings. Young children are taught compassion before they can even speak. You know, a mother will point to an insect and say, oh, poor thing, it's going the wrong way, when their baby is just little. And they're taught to feel with others from the beginning. And I remember Banjo buried his grown-up son, Ian, whom I was very fond of. And Banjo was quite proud of following the stretcher out into the ambulance. And he called out, Ian, don't lose, wake up, Ian. And he felt as if the whole, you could tell, he felt as if the whole universe was calling out with him. And he was feeling the appropriate, deep, right feelings, and he was proud of being emotional. And then the moon came out and shone on Ian's face, and it looked as if he'd come alive again. And Ian had always spoken of how beautiful the moon was, and he had called to his parents out to come and have a look, and he had said, the most beautiful thing is it's coming up over our forest, over our tribal land. So it meant a lot to him that the big moon shone on Ian's face at that moment. Anyway, this is the thing. They express their emotions totally, and people who live with Aboriginal people find they become more emotional than they did before.
Yeah, you can hear it in the phone call, even with you. I mean, you can hear the emotion, and that's such a... We really try and help people a lot with that on Best Ever You, to express what they're feeling and say what they're feeling. And sometimes that happens in the United States even, where, you know, boys are taught to not cry or not emote.
Yes.
You know, it just depends on the culture. I hear what you're saying. That's refreshing, though, to hear that there's a culture where, you know, you're taught to express your emotion rather than bottle it all up. Because a lot of us are taught to just deal.
Yes, well, you can imagine when Aboriginal children were massacred and such, how confusing it was that these adults, white adults, were not feeling emotions, were proud of not feeling.
Oh, yeah. It's just so opposite of who they are. It's just a complete clash.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, in one of the things I heard in your stories there of sharing that was the confusion between a camellia and a rose. And I moved here to Maine from California, and that was one of the camellias. That's my absolute most favorite. don't know if it's a flower. It's actually like a it really does. You can confuse it with a rose bush, but it yes. it just blooms. It's not prone to the disease and so forth that roses are, and it's just constant beautiful blooms. It's my absolute just favorite. I'm going to call it a flower for people. Somebody can correct me if it's not an actual flower, but a bush or whatever. But those are beautiful. Beautiful. Yes. I'm curious. Your name is pretty close to that. Is that one of your favorite
yes,
flowers?
Yes, actually, Benjo called it a Camilla flower. He said it was a Camilla flower.
Yeah.
And I didn't actually know his wife. His wife died when she didn't need to because of injustice, white injustice, but his children, we spent 3 days going over the book Wisdom Man for his children to have their say as to what should be put in. And, sorry, I've got a frog in my throat suddenly. they insisted that their mother had said it was a rose. But Banjo had said it was a Camilla flower.
And is it a Camilla or a Camellia? I don't know if I say that wrong. Is it a Camilla?
The flower is a Camellia.
A Camellia. Yeah, I thought it was. Yeah. I couldn't. Yeah, have you ever thought of changing your name? I'm just curious. Have you ever thought of changing your name to Camellia or keep it as, you know, just to actually make it match that flower? Or just keep it Camilla?
That's a wonderful question. As a matter of fact, I dislike my name Camilla, and there are two alternatives. I love the way Italian and Spanish people pronounce my name, so that's Camilla, and it's just so beautiful, and that's even closer to Camellia.
Uh-huh.
But Banjo also gave me a tribal name. He initiated me, and my tribal name is Waramye, which means left-handed woman.
Huh.
So it's a very interesting question.
Say that again. Say the tribal name.
Waramye.
Huh. How do you spell that?
Waramyea.
I get it now. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That's how it was interesting. I asked you before we went on to make sure how you pronounced your name, because I would have pronounced it Camellia as well.
Yes.
It's funny.
I prefer that.
It's beautiful. Yeah, probably more like Camellia Chance or something, you know, to give a kind of more of an accent to it. But in America, we're Camilla Chance. that's the Iowa part of me. that's beautiful. And wouldn't you agree that that's just one of the most beautiful flowers? I mean, it's
a very beautiful flower, but it goes brown if you touch it. It's very sensitive.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I don't think.
Yeah.
I think I've always just spent time looking at them, going, "Wow, those are so pretty." But really interesting. Okay, well, we'll keep going here because I've got a million questions here still. So we were talking about forgiveness and the amazing ability for Aboriginals to forgive. And Banjo was also known to forgive people. I like this in multiples, 1,000 times 1,000. Do you have any stories about that?
Well, that's how Wisdom Man has changed people, Elizabeth. Those who read the book are changed by it. Everywhere I go, people say to me, I had a friend who was angry as a way of life, but he read Wisdom Man and became peaceful. Or else they say, before I met Banjo's all-forgiving character in the book, I could not forgive the people who harmed me in the past. But now I can move on. Banjo himself believed that humankind should wipe its slate clean of interracial torment, and that the tormentors and victims of the past should meet as for the first time in peace and unity. I could tell our listeners a million incidents, but I think they need to read the book. Anyway, If you insist, I will tell you a story or two.
Can I insist?
You insist?
Yes, I insist.
Okay. Well, one time Banjo was in a pub, and there was a man there that was abusing him and his race, and there were no holds barred to the things he was saying. It was really terrible. And the publican ordered Banjo out of the pub because he was the Aboriginal and that's what you did. You know, Banjo was fairly young at the time. And years later, this man turned up on Banjo's doorstep and knocked on the door and said, "I've lost my way. I have a job cutting wood in the bush, in the forest, and I don't know where to go, and my car has broken down, and I need to telephone." And Banjo said, "Come in, warm yourself by the fire. I'll bring you a cup of tea. We don't have a telephone, but I will lead you to where your job is." So after the man had warmed himself by the fire and Banjo had given him what food he had in the house and a cup of tea, they went on their way and Banjo took him through the forest. And it was dark, dark, dark night. And they were just going through the forest and the man was getting more and more nervous and Banjo, of course, being a sensitive Aboriginal person, could feel it. And the man said, "Do you know who I am?" And Banjo said, "Yes, I know." The man said, "You could kill me here and nobody would know." And Banjo said, "Yes, I know." And the man said, "Why don't you?" And Banjo said, "I want you to realize that Aboriginals feel exactly the same as any human being. They can be kind too, you know." And Banjo led him to his job where he had to work the next morning. And the man said, "From now on, I'll tell my children never to be prejudiced again, that all prejudice is destructive." So anyhow, that's one of the brief stories.
Yeah. That just absolutely just sent shivers up my spine. Oh, my goodness. Yep, that's a life lesson right there, isn't it? I'm going to leave that one alone. I'm not going to ask any questions about that one. Just going to leave that one as is. It says it all. Now, the book, Wisdom Man, was an instant bestseller. It's on Kindle now. It's been featured on Australian television 3 times as a documentary, and it's won a number of awards. Sometimes we're into awards. awards are kind of fun. We like awards. What award is, you know, and sometimes, you know, it's like, it's great, you know, I do all those things and here's an award and whatever. But is there an award that you've received that's just really meant just so very much to you?
Well, I got a couple of awards from the United States, but the award that meant most to me was from Aboriginal people. It was important because I don't want to step out of line. I don't want to say anything Aboriginals wouldn't want me to say. And at the second launch of Wisdom Man, there were 500 people in the audience, nearly all Aboriginal, from all over Australia. And suddenly, the mistress of ceremonies broke from the program and said, "Camilla knows nothing about this, and indeed I didn't, but we Aboriginals are going to give her an award. The rules for this award are that it should only be given to an Aboriginal person, but we know that it should be given to Camilla. It is our Unsung Hero Award. For someone who has worked behind the scenes, not pushing him or herself forward for the betterment of Aboriginal people. This award is not given lightly or regularly. It is given only when we are inspired to give it." And so the people gave me the most beautiful statue of a huge, finely veined glass leaf, blown by Aboriginal people, with "Camilla Chance," or Chance if you like, "a friend to all," written on its base.
Oh.
Of course I burst into tears.
Oh, I think I'd burst into more than that. I mean, that's just amazing. Oh, isn't that just sweet? And where do you just carry that around with you all the time right now? You must just, when you go to the grocery store, you've got your award in one hand and a bag of groceries in the other. I mean, that just says it all, doesn't it?
Yes, it said a lot. Yes, it said a lot.
Yeah.
So I value that very highly, yeah.
Oh, that's very sweet. We've got on Kindle, that's a really big deal because that makes it, you know, a little bit more accessible to all the various readers and things like that we have. So it's on Kindle. People can buy the book anywhere where books are sold, right? You can just, I mean, we could go in anywhere and just ask for a copy of your book or have one ordered. Can you buy the book on Amazon?
Well, it's published by Penguin. It's published by Penguin. Yeah.
Okay.
It's on Amazon.
It's on Amazon.
Yeah.
So anywhere, you can just Google Wisdom Man or go to Wisdom Man Book. We're running out of time. We've got about 5 minutes left. And I wondered if there's anything that you could say to our listeners, you know, in these last final moments of the show here that might make an immediate difference to our lives.
Well, Elizabeth, I'm sure you know this already, but it really makes a difference if first thing in the morning you give thanks for the beautiful day that is about to happen. Because if you do that, you notice the good things in that day all through the day. You can do it in the evening as well, but the morning is important because that way everybody you meet will be affected by your happiness. Anyway,
Do you think that's hard to do some days? Like how would you? I'm gonna just keep, if you don't mind, just in practice. Sounds like a really easy thing to do, to get up and say, "Wow, thank you, and what a great day we're gonna have."
Yes.
Do you think that's easy to do for everybody?
Well, sometimes more than others.
Do you think you know, I really learned, you know, part of my book that, you know, the book that we wrote that's coming out, you know, I think about my dad a lot, and my dad's a stroke survivor and a kidney cancer survivor, and, you know, he's gone through just horrible medical issues since 2004 now, and he has that same thought. He says that. You know, he's 70 plus years old, and he says, you know, he calls me Lisa. He goes, you know, Lisa, you know, you wake up every day and you just are thankful for the day. And I'm like, how can you say that? And you know, how after everything you've been through, you're grateful for that. You know, and you know, I ask him questions, and yes, the answer is yes. He's like, I'm still talking to you, right?
It makes you notice the good things. And it makes you remember good things, too. And the good things take over more, you know. And it's easy to forget little good things. And yet the little things are very, very important.
Yeah,
they're
really
big things.
That's what he says, too. He said, you know, it's not so much the big things, but it's all the little things that matter. And the big ones, too. But he just has... I mean, my dad, we're going to go a little bit long here, too, for anybody listening. The show cuts off live, but you can listen on replay. Go to blogtalkradio.com/besteveryou, and the show is on replay, and you can listen to the very end of the show because we'll close out properly here. But just to share with you a little bit more about my dad, he definitely has that philosophy of just incredible gratitude. And since he's been ill, he's taken 2 trips out of Minnesota, each to Maine. And, you know, from having strokes, my dad is pretty blind, frail, ill, and everything. And he gets on airplanes to come and see me, you know, and see the kids and hug us and pet the dog and hug my husband and all, you know, all these things. And he's a warrior.
Yes.
Would you say...
Well, love has made him a warrior, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
He pets your dog, he hugs you and the children, yes.
Yeah, would you, just in closing here, would you say Banjo was kind of like that too, and would you say you're like that as well? persevering.
Yes, Banjo said if he let himself get angry, he would be incredibly angry. But he never let himself get angry. That was his decision. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a deliberate decision.
Kind of like a just pure peace and so forth. And it is a deliberate. I think my dad makes that choice too. Like it's really a deliberate choice and a mindset and things. It's wisdom for sure to pass along for sure.
Yes.
Well. Oh, is there anything I didn't cover? Because you are just fascinating, and I have so enjoyed this hour with you. What a
I can
thank
tell
you.
We're off air now. I think the tone of the telephone is different.
Okay. All right. Well, it's in record mode. But thank you so very, very much for being with us. And for those listening, you can go to wisdommanbook.com. The book is Wisdom Man. In short, let me read the whole title here. Just to make sure I get a Wisdom Man by Banjo Clark as told to Camilla. No, I'm just kidding.
Camilla
Tam. I love your name.
Camilla Chance.
Yes, Camilla Chance. The passionate life and beliefs of a remarkable Aboriginal elder. So thank you so much for being with us. And I hope
and
you have
www.wisdommanbook.com. Yes.
And I hope you have just an absolute beautiful day there in Australia. And we'll have a beautiful night here in the United States. And just thank you so very, very much for being with us. And thank you again to Sherry Rosen. Thank you.
Sleep well, Elizabeth. Sleep well and wake very happy in the morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Best Ever You Show. Want more? Visit us at besteveryou.com. Be your best and keep it real. Confident, successful, caring, and beautiful every day with Best Ever You.